Good day, nerds, and welcome to episode 102 of the Nerd Cantina Show. And today we've got a Cantina conversation, again with our book reviewer, Megan McCarthy-Bianc. And today she's sitting down with the co-authors of The Devastation Class, Elaine Mangin and Glenn Zipper. In this interview, Megan goes in depth in their transition and decisions towards writing this novel in the first place. Both Elaine and Glenn come from a film background, and the path towards getting this book published was a very interesting one. And they talk about the development of this story, as well as how they came up with this with a long journey in mind towards future sequels. It's a great interview, and we hope you enjoy.
We are here with Glenn Zipper and Elaine Mangin. Elaine, I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Yes, you got it right. Thank you.
Awesome. Authors of A Devastation Class. First of all, thank you once again for making time for us. And, you know, I read the book. I love the book. And I'm really excited to have you guys here so that we can, like, add an extra layer of what you're sharing with the world and with our audience, and for people who tune in. So thank you so much for squeezing us in and talking to us about it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Okay. So you both have pretty impressive resumes or IMDb sheets, so to speak. So Glenn, your background is more heavily in like documentaries and production. And Elaine, you both write, but Elaine writes and directs mostly, correct? And then you have like a lot of film crew experience throughout the years too. So, and then you both have worked together on a couple projects as well, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, because I think I did watch Good Morning and Swiped to Death, which were both they're pretty good. I didn't know what to expect with very short, 8 to 12 minute film, but no, it was really entertaining, and it definitely had that little shock factor at the end of both of those. So I really appreciated those. It was really cool. So what kind of pushed you to take on literature, like take on entertainment in literature form versus what you're used to in terms of a lot of your experience and your projects in the past have been for film or other types of screens, either short film or longer series. And so what kind of made you decide to take on literature and write a novel series?
Want to take that one, Elaine?
Sure. So Devastation Class actually started as a TV concept that Glenn and I dreamt up. And we had written a few scripts, and we wanted to have a fanboy, non-industry fanboy read. So we sent it to my friend. We sent it to a few people, but one of them was my friend Tom in New York, who was designing book jackets at the time for a publisher. And he read it, and he was like, I love this. This is awesome. If you can't get it going as a series, maybe you should consider writing it as a YA novel series because, I'm having to read a lot of YA right now because I'm designing these jackets, and it would really fit right in. And so about 6 months later, we had given it to some people in the industry and we got positive feedback, but because we were nobodies, no one really wanted to support us or support the project. So Tom said, where are you with it? And we said, we're basically nowhere. And he said, hey, can I give it to a couple of my editors? And so he gave it to his editors and they really, really liked the material and set a call with us. And they said, this is great. We love the world. We love the characters, but we don't know if you can write prose. And so we need proof that you can write prose. So we advise that you write a book proposal.
Right.
Okay.
Just interject and say, we definitely, Elaine's telling the sort of somewhat sanitized version of it because the real version is, can you write a book? And we said, absolutely, we can write a book, no problem, in our sleep. Next week, hung up the phone and we sort of looked at each other and we're like, all right, can we Google how to write a book?
Or like fake it till you make it. Like, yeah, we got this.
Totally.
Then you did present it to them kind of like in a screen written concept like form.
Originally, it was 3 episodes.
Okay.
And we had a Bible as well for the first season of the show.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, because I definitely like, it's definitely suspense and action driven. And you, I think you definitely kind of get hints of that as where, you know, it was kind of in, you could kind of tell almost in a sense that it was, because some books are like very character driven or backstory driven. And you do kind of like sprinkle some backstory here and there. And so like me as the reader, I was kind of like, you know, you left little tidbits where I was like, okay, this explains that, this explains that. And you kind of tease us with it. Because you are planning a series. And so no, that's really interesting that, you know, you did start it off as like a screen concept, and then you kind of had to go back and say, okay, now we have, yeah, we could do this. Okay. How do we do this? Yeah. We got to like kind of switch a game plan here. And so your industry, your colleague, he suggested young adult. Cause I was kind of wondering like why you chose young adult versus like another age group.
It was always young adults. You know, the concept, the original concept was always going to be centered around these young men and women who were put in an impossible situation and then had to make an impossible choice. And really the evolution from it being a television concept where, you know, we had a pilot and a few episodes to, you know, a book, it actually allowed us to expand the universe. Because if you're making a TV show, you know, you like to use The Walking Dead as an example. You know, so you sure. have the sort of the long arc of a season where, you know, they have to, there's different settings every season, but, you know, you want to see, like, are they going to be able to get out of this larger predicament that happens over the course of, you know, 11 episodes?
Yeah.
Also, you need self-contained stories each episode, sort of the B stories, the character-driven stories. And when we transitioned from a television concept to a book, we were essentially relieved of the obligation of having to have these little vignette anecdotal stories, you know, where, you know, it's an even better example would be Star Trek, where, you know, it would be the larger adventure stories, but then you'd be like, oh, this is a Picard episode.
No. Okay. Yeah.
Like, oh, this is a Data episode. So we didn't have to worry about being democratic and being like, all right, so this episode's going to be about this character. This episode's going to be about this character. We were able to concentrate on the larger world, the larger universe, and have all of these characters work together as an ensemble.
Yeah. So was that like, cause I'm just kind of curious as to like, I guess what I imagine that was just a challenge within itself. Because your experience, your professional career has been so heavily involved in writing, and producing for screen. And so, you know, what was like, for this process, like coming from your background, what was it like? Maybe two-part question of like, what was your favorite part about the whole process? Like maybe biggest lessons learned. And then what were like the biggest challenges of this process? Kind of like, you know, having to switch gears.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, do you want to start?
The favorite.
Well, I would say, I think we agree that the best part of what is, something that is a fact about filmmaking is never just a director's vision that's being executed on. It requires, as cliche as it sounds, it takes a village. You have your writer, you have your director, you have your producers, you have your cinematographer, you have your editors, you have your production coordinators and production managers and grips and gaffers and first ADs and so on, and special effects people and set dressers and set designers. And all of these people have to come together and work as a team and find a chemistry in order to make a great film.
Yeah.
And also part of that process requires a lot of compromise because you have all these talented people coming together and they have, you know, they're all driving towards attaining one specific vision, but they sort of do bring their own vision for that project to the table each time.
Sure.
Those are going to butt up against one another every once in a while. So these compromises are going to be made. So when you look at a finished film, you know, the great ones, the not so great ones, the bad ones, they are all in some respect. We should say like a horse by committee is a camel. And so all of them are a bit of a camel, but, you know, some of them are great camels. When you go into writing a book, it's really just you writing it. Of course, you eventually have to show it to an editor and the editor will go, this is great. This is great. This is actually very not great. Please change. but until you get to that point, you're really on an island, you know, by yourselves. And there's an incredible amount of freedom there. But it's also, you know, one of the negative things too, because you don't get that feedback. You don't have that constant sort of push and pull with other people. And so you can sort of go all the way out into left field and you know, end up completely lost. And so you're always worried that, you know, when we do show this to somebody, how are they going to react? And because it's such a personal thing that you've done, it's poured out of your soul without the contribution of other people, if they react negatively, it's pretty gut-wrenching.
Oh, man. No, that totally makes sense. Because then it's like, you know, the collaboration is there, but it's kind of like a step-by-step. There's certain phases that you go through with the novel versus, you know, when you're working on a film project where all that collaboration is just kind of like ongoing, like you get feedback like almost immediately. Whereas during a novel, it's like you kind of, it's almost like you get the first draft and then you get feedback and, you know, that's when they either chop it up or maybe, you know, or maybe they're like, oh, this is amazing. Or, you know, maybe nitpick at it only a little bit. And so, yeah, I imagine that was like a major like switch for you because you didn't get any of that feedback that you're used to during that first initial drafting phase.
And you're right.
Except amongst each other. We're constantly bouncing things off of each other and being sounding boards for one another during the process. But that's just us in our like little cocoon.
Pre-quarantine bubble, different type of bubble.
Oh, no, right? No, but I think that's good. At least you had experience working with one another on similar projects so that at least, you know, you kind of charted this unfamiliar territory together. So I imagine that might have, you know, helped take the edge off a little bit in terms of any, you know, reservations you might have had of having to like, you know, going into a new project in a whole different approach to it.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
What did you like the most about writing for literature versus like writing for screen?
Well, for me, in documentaries, you know, you're always beholden to your budget. You know, we've all want to do.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, that would be great. But have to mortgage the house, donate my blood, go to Vegas, hit it big. And so you really are constrained by the limits of your wallet. Whereas when you're making a book, you're writing a book, really the only ceiling is the limit of your imagination. And so that was, I think, the most exciting thing for both of us. When we were writing the book, in that there was literally nowhere we couldn't take the story. And as producers, every once in a while, because we knew that we wanted this to be adapted into a film or a TV series one day.
Sure.
But we'd write certain things. We go, "Oh, this is really going to piss off that producer or that one day." Sort of like, oh, he's going to have to blow up this planet. Okay. Well, worry about that when she's producing the film. I do think that having that no creative constraints in terms of how we tell the story was probably the best thing about working in this medium.
Yeah, I agree.
So then kind of like piggybacking off of that, was there a lot of like, what kind of conflict, if any, in terms of fleshing out the story? Maybe try to be a little as spoiler free as possible, or maybe minor spoilers, but like, were there any scenes that you guys kind of like fought over, or was there something that, you know, one of you was really attached to and the other person kind of had to make the case of like, well, this doesn't really make sense, like plot wise or whatever, or like, no, this character wouldn't do that, or, you know, any other things where you guys kind of had to like, like how you said, compromise amongst yourselves, or maybe you were attached to something that you just didn't want to let go. And how, you know, how that kind of like came, you know, resolved.
Yeah. Well, the first two that come to mind, the first sort of major conflict that Elaine and I had in the book was if we were going to write it in first person or third person. And we started writing the book, in third person, and I was pretty insistent upon that. And
the reason was because you can have this sort of omniscient voice telling the story. You don't have to be in one character's head. Right?
Yes, because we knew that, you know, this is the type of story where different things are going to be happening simultaneously in different places of the ship and different places of the universe. You know, and if you're in the head of one character, you know, how do we tell that kind of story?
Right.
And I think my first instinct was, well, let's not stay in the head of any one character. Let's, you know, go with the proverbial voice of God. And something about it that wasn't quite working. And Elaine kept pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing until I wanted to jump off. No, I'm just kidding. but she was very insistent that we should try to take a look at transitioning to having it be a first person multi-character perspective. And eventually I got so worn down by her constant bringing that up that I was like, you know what, why don't you just go away and rewrite three chapters in the first person, and they're going to be terrible, and then I will read it and I will tell you what I already know, that it's awful. And then like, fine. And then she goes away and she comes back, and it could have been a month later, and she sends me a few chapters in the first person. And I started reading it angry, because I was like, I told you this was going to be bad. It's not bad. It's much, much better. So it fell between my legs. I had to say to Elaine, you're right. And then we embarked on writing the rest of the book in the multi-character first-person perspective. Then the other big one, which I think is a bit of a tiny little spoiler, is there was a whole other perspective in this book that we took out.
Okay.
And I think we actually, we think it's a better book for it. But it's still, that character was so much fun to write that it was hard for us to take out the perspective, and that's Bossa. And he's sort of the character that's not aligned with any one side in this book. So to have the freedom to tell sort of his perspective, which is critical of what everybody's doing, because he's removed from everything that he's seeing, and he's a funny character. So it gave
us
the ability to, have a few more jokes, to be a bit lighter at times. The spoiler is he 100%. His perspective is 100% going to be in book 2.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And book 2 will have the perspective of other characters. It won't just be the characters that you've met and whose perspective we told the story through in book 1.
Well, would you say the same, Elaine, is that, the bigger conflicts was deciding between the first and the third person and having to prove it to him, literally, on paper?
Yeah, I mean, that one. And then we had another one where we were kind of struggling with making specifically Viv's and JD's voices unique.
Mm-hmm.
And in trying to figure out how we would do that, one of the ideas thrown out was to make her, from Texas with a drawl and very specific way of talking. And I was very much against that because in my mind, she was not that at all.
Sure.
So we, we kind of went back and forth on that and ultimately gave her a different way of speaking and an inner dialogue where she literally talks to herself to differentiate her. And also word choice, certain words she uses, are not words that JD would use and vice versa, just to give them some differentiation.
Yeah, because that kind of made me wonder, actually, one of the questions I wanted to ask was, how did you choose the characters to feature? Which points of view, how did you choose the characters that would be featured as the speakers?
Well, JD and Viv were always, JD and Viv were always our main characters from the very beginning of, from the inception of the concept, even when it was a TV show. So that was definitely an obvious.
And then
Liko, we felt it was really important to add a character that was a student.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that we had the student's perspective as well. And Liko also having his background and his history brought forward so that perspective, it's a key perspective in the overall story of the Alliance and the Kastazi. So that was that. And then Nicholas, you can speak to Nicholas. Glenn.
Right. Well, Nicholas, the entire mystery of Devastation Class and the Devastation Class trilogy sort of lives inside of Nicholas.
Okay.
Both literally and figuratively. And so we absolutely had to let the audience into not only his perspective and his mind, but what is essentially his own existential crisis, which is at the heart of the themes of the book. What is free will? Where did we come from? And how frightening and how challenging it is for all of us to have questions about our own identity. And so that's the foundational reason why his perspective was always going to be critical to the book.
Yeah. And it was with him, it kind of almost reminded me of, you know, maybe this is also minor spoiler, maybe major spoiler. Maybe I don't want to talk too much. I'll ask them to edit it out if we just see like if it's too much. But it did remind me of a little Westworld action where, you know, they're kind of, they explore those same themes. And, you know, you see certain players and certain characters and they're not quite, you know, it's something about them that's revealed later. And I remember, I don't know, maybe I'm the type of reader that doesn't always like catch on too quickly. And maybe that's a good thing. But I had an interview recently with a person who Daniel Krauss, that he just recently released The Living Dead with George Romero, and always really interesting conversations with him. And he was kind of talking about how with a book that he released with Bent Heavens, there's like a reveal, there's several reveals, but one of them, it's like, kind of halfway through the book. And he's like, no, like, you know, about, I would say about a third of the readers get it, mm-hmm. which is, and it's okay. Like, he's like, okay with that. Cause it means like, it wasn't too obvious, but it was just like, just there enough where people could still figure it out. And then once they kind of, you kind of take it from there and then you kind of like linger on that and reflect on that. Like, cause that's what I felt like with a couple characters, like once certain in Devastation Class, once certain things were revealed, it kind of made me reflect and be like, wait a second. mm-hmm. And then you kind of like have this whole new perspective of certain, you know, actions, certain points of view, certain thoughts, certain
choices.
Yeah. Like little tidbits, little events that take place and you're like, oh, like after the fact, and you don't really, maybe you don't really think about it at first, or maybe you do and you're kind of like onto that person. And then it's revealed and you're like, oh shit, like, okay, wait a second, like, wait a second. Like, this is like, this changes the whole playing field now. So I think that was like one of my favorite parts. I think maybe just myself as a reader in general, where I don't always like, you know, maybe I try to make myself feel better. That's a good thing that maybe I didn't catch on too quickly, but especially what, you know, with how other details were revealed and, you know, later on in the book, which, you know, obviously I won't go over because that one was just too good to realize, like, it was another oh shit moment. Like,
well, we hope to have, yeah, I'm glad that it had that effect on you. I'm sure that Elaine's really excited about that as well. I will say that there's actually quite a bit of stuff like that in the book, but they're all across the spectrum from like 1 to 10, 1 being the stuff that like you are going to see coming, that, you know, like you totally got it. And then stuff like you're talking about now, which is like a 5 or a 6 on that scale of like, some people will get it, some people won't get it.
Yeah.
There's also stuff in the book that's a 10, like we know you didn't get it.
Yeah.
Because the point is, we don't want you to get it in book 1. But then when you read book 2, we want you to go, holy shit, that was happening the whole time in book 1.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, or you kind of led the leader in where now it's like, I'm on to you. Like, I'm on to it. I'm going to keep an eye out. I'm going to keep a closer eye out now.
Yeah,
for book 2.
So many Easter eggs planted in the book. And we think that, you know,
yeah,
multiple reads from some people, I think that people will discover more and more things as they, you know, read it multiple times.
Yeah, no, I that would be one of the books. That kind of brings me to another question, actually, because a lot of, you go through it, like a lot of terminology. There's like, it's like very, you know, military chain of command structure, just because of the setting, you know, they're part of a mission or space exploration. And there's, you know, this grueling process of becoming a cadet. And then with the students, it's all very like rules based and kind of like that hierarchy and that, you know, just that type of environment. So like, what kind of like, you know, like research went into kind of taking this route of, you know, like almost like a military base in space,
yeah,
so to speak. Well, yeah.
I think, you know, my background, before I was a writer and producer, I was a criminal prosecutor. Right. So, you know, I work in a very hierarchical structure. You know, there's assistant prosecutors, and then there, you know, there's the actual prosecutor, and there's a pecking order within,
yeah,
the prosecutor and the assistant prosecutors, and
people, right,
people who report to people, and sort of that structure of what, of how you need to behave relative to the person who's superior to you, what those dynamics are, and what it means when you break that rule structure, or when you step over a boundary that you're not supposed to in a hierarchy. That's sort of the mushier stuff that I had a lot of experience with, and there's a lot of emotion and stakes that are imbued within that, that I was able to, along with Elaine, pay forward into the book. The actual military structure, when we're trying to be literal about it, I think we both came to the table with just some anecdotal understanding of, you know, hierarchical structure within the military. But we did run it by some people in the military, and we just said, did we get this right?
Yeah.
And I think with two exceptions, everything was endorsed, and anywhere that they said, well, you didn't get this exactly right, then we went back and then we adjusted. Is that right, Elaine?
Yeah. And we, you know, I think before that we did our online research first and then, you know, wanted to get some confirmation that it would work that way. So.
Yeah. And I guess, like, you know, because of your experience, I'm sure you know a handful of people in your network where you've kind of had to do this type of thing before for creating and writing and producing film, where you have to do research on all these different topics and environments. And, you know, even if you're, even, you know, you were saying, Glenn, in your background and as assistant prosecutor, you said, yeah. And then when you kind of, you know, that could still transfer, those kind of politics can, you know, could still transfer into any industry with, you know, the pecking order of, you know, being on set and, you know, who's in charge of what and who has to listen to who. And, you know, there's things that are expected of you and of others. And so, and even that, when you're working on different projects, you have to do the research to really do right by your story. Mm-hmm. And so, I was really interested because, you know, I read a lot of books, and when I read all these details that like go into these certain environments, setting the scene, setting the background stories and all that, I'm just thinking like, that's like kind of the other things that I think about is where, oh my God, like what were their resources? How much research went into this? And so, I thought, you know, something kind of taking it a step further, like off world and, you know, taking into that like kind of Star Trek vibe, but also still saying like, no, we're, you know, there's still Earth. There's still, you know, a team. They're still following that, you know, that pecking order. And then that's kind of all they know. And then when they kind of progress through the story and they realize some of the choices they make, you know, the decisions save them, but only because of other, you know, they realize what they did. And it's like, you know, it worked because of the specific thing that they did. And then when they realize the implications of that, the consequences, and it's too late to go back. And it has, you know, you see the implications on the other characters too, or there's just still this so much conflict within the ship and within the teams. And it almost doesn't seem to matter anymore because the world just got that much bigger somehow. Yeah. I didn't know how it could get bigger with these, like they're fighting, you know, their big space exploration, but a lot of it was put into perspective where, and then you see how some of the characters realize that sooner than others. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, yeah, where, you know, you could kind of see like, dude, drop this pettiness, like look around, like, do you not understand? Like, this is bigger than us. This doesn't matter anymore. And then
exactly.
Yeah. And, no, that was great. And I thought it was so crazy how there's like the student size is what, like 10 times bigger than the cadets, but you know, maybe that's how it happens a lot where like it's like the us versus them mentality. And unfortunately the people who are higher ranked are vastly outnumbered. Mm-hmm. And when this huge like catastrophe happens and it's like, it's our, you know, whatever, you know, conflict was brewing, it just explodes. Like it's go time. And that's what I appreciate about having Liko too, is as a point of view, because you were touching about it before where you see, you know, you kind of have to like introduce the other sides and there would be Kasazi sympathizers, and you know, you have it, the offspring of one where it's like, of course he, unfortunately, because that's a running theme I noticed also. I know I'm gonna like go all over the place. That's a running theme also in this book, is where like these are the children who are either trying to live up to their parents' legacy or trying to get away from it or trying to make their own. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really interesting how you presented the characters who, on one side, their parents are like legends and they're veterans and, you know, they know everybody knows who they are because of their parents. And then also people like Liko, who, you know, who his parents are for not so good reason, not so legendary. It's legendary kind of like an infamous way. And so, I think that was like a really interesting way to take it. And then having to force them to kind of reconcile and look past it and look at the bigger picture, I think definitely helped not only drive the story, but then it's like, by the time you get there, it's like something else, some other ambush is happening. And it's like, okay, oh my God. All right. We're, we don't have time for this. Like, quit.
I have to tell you.
You know, and it's a lot, you know, it's for the characters. I kind of felt like lost with them, and it's a lot for them to handle too. You know, having to grapple with what they did in addition to where do we go from here? Like, we have no idea what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you something that you're probably not realizing as you're saying this. I'm sure Elaine is having the same reaction I am, which is like, wow, she really got it.
Yeah. No, I'm a big bookworm. So I think I just like, you know, after a while, I just, you know, I kind of like reflect on, I enjoy character driven stories, but the plot and the action, helps drive it along too. Cause sometimes, you know, you pay attention, you get so heavily involved in these characters, but then it's really cool to like, I don't know, maybe it's just like that part of analyzing literature too, where you kind of just consider all points of view and then you consider these actions. And then I just think it's fascinating when you have to create characters that are, you know, maybe are the opposite personality of you. And then you kind of have to dive deeper and think, how would they, you know, what makes sense for this character's actions right now? Like, how would they respond to this particular situation?
Yeah, and I think you got all of that. And
yeah, 100%.
Another theme of the book is either we, as human beings, we have these patterns that the world is sort of ingrains in us. And we do things because that's how we've been told to do them. That's how we've been trained to do them. And these characters have their hierarchical structure, and then something happens that sends their world into sort of essentially oblivion. And from that point forward, like, does the hierarchical structure even matter anymore?
Right.
Like, you know, why would they keep doing it the way they've always done it? But they do, or they try to. And the question is doing what they've always done and following their training and following the patterns that are ingrained in them, did that save them?
Ooh. Right.
Holding on to those patterns and doing things the way they've always done that, is that actually going to destroy them? And those are existential questions that we have, I think, ourselves every day. And you definitely, seems like you came across that as you were reading the book.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even just thinking as, you know, you are even as the reader, you're kind of looking at, you're like, you either agree or disagree with certain actions, but you know, at the end of the day, like, you don't know. Like, you'd like to think that you would be a smart and logical person, but it's like, have you ever been in a situation where, you know, you're being attacked and you're responsible for like, you know, 80 something lives on board, and it's, you don't know what you would do, but it's, yeah, you bring up a good point. It's like, what was their training and their experience and their intelligence and their, you know, their patterns that they had been ingrained. Yeah. Like, at the time it made sense to them, but then it's like, well, they have to explain their actions because there's a whole bunch of people who don't trust them at all, who have no reason to, and who don't, you know, who also don't need to see any reason to follow the pecking order anymore.
And I think another important thing is that one of the earliest notes we got in the book from our editors was she was calling into question the choices of some of the characters. Like, why would they do that? Like, just, and I go, okay, imagine you were 18 years old and you had that decision about that would either save the world or the universe or not save the universe. And that decision also involves whether some of your friends are going to die.
Yeah.
I mean, are you going to sometimes make a really stupid decision? Are you sometimes going to make the short-sighted decision because you have an extraordinary amount of pressure on you, that life or death scenario? Yeah, you might make the wrong decision 80% of the time.
Right.
It's fair to ask the question, like, why would they choose this? It's a stupid, or it's not the smartest way to go about this. Like, if you stopped and took a deep breath, there's 9 other safer ways to go about this. But if you're 18 and you're to die, very good chance you're going to make the wrong, perhaps even stupid decision in that scenario. And once we were able to explain that to, you know, editors who might have been a bit older and not really been in tune anymore, her former 18-year-old decision-making process, she was like, oh yeah,
right,
of course.
Yeah, no, I that's exactly right. I think, you know, I think that's probably why this will kind of resonate with young adult audiences too, is that age range. It's like that decision-making, you know, it's, depends on the scenario, of course, but at the end of the day, I think a lot of readers said it's been a long time since we've been that in that age group too. So it definitely depends on like either the generation or, you know, the age and if you can kind of like, you know, cause it's easy to be detached once you know better,
yes.
But then it's, you know, there's another argument to be made that these young adults, these 18, 17 year olds have more life experience because of their training. And so, you know, it could go either way on that. And so I think we're approaching our mark. I just want to ask a couple more questions because I do want to be respectful of your time. It went by kind of quickly.
It did.
So I love the cover. It's so cool. It makes you wonder like what's going on? So how much say or input, you know, did you have in generating the cover of the book?
Total. We did the cover ourselves with an artist. We didn't actually do the graphic design.
Sure.
We worked with Michelle Holm, who also does the cover art for all of Bruce Springsteen's stuff.
Oh.
She's actually won a Grammy for her work on album covers.
Oh, interesting.
And there's a friend of mine named Tom Zimney, a very successful, extraordinarily talented documentary director who actually has made a lot of films for Bruce and with Bruce. And he was the one who introduced me to Michelle. And Michelle, when we talked to her and we explained what our vision was and sort of the things that we wanted to make sure were on the cover, not only to represent the story itself, but the possibilities going forward in the trilogy, she just got it. And we worked together on it. And then her first pass at it was very close to what ended up on in the actual cover.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
She had sent us some comps of different ideas, there was something else I was going to say. Sorry.
You were going to say how cool I am and what.
Oh, yeah, totally. Right. Totally. Oh, no, I was going to say, you know, we're actually really lucky that we were able to hire our own artist, because I have talked to some other people in the book world and they're like, right. Wow, like you guys got to spearhead that. That's
right.
Like, that really happened very often. So, you know, we were really passionate about finding the right person and the right art for this.
Yeah, no, that's because I often ask that of authors when there's a particular cover that, you know, because I know it's different for everybody. Sometimes it's just consulting. Sometimes they have no say whatsoever. And, you know, sometimes even then they get lucky where the illustrator kind of like hits it on point. And then other times it's like, you know, they could say, no, I hate it. And then there's like, kind of like, well, too bad. This is what's going out, you know? And it also depends on, I think, on who, you know, like bookshelf featured, like what else is being released around that same time. You know, how is this cover going to stand out versus what is also being released either that week or that month. And so, yeah, no, I just thought that was really interesting because it does kind of capture like, you know, the mood. It kind of foreshadows the mood. It kind of foreshadows like, you know, what they're kind of dealing with eventually. And that you can tell, you can see it in their posture. Like they have to make tough decisions and it's like, now what? Like, this is, yeah, it's no, I loved it. And so one last question, obviously trying to be a little spoiler free. What can we look forward to in the sequels?
Well, I think that I could say a couple things. One, we already said, which is you're going to get inside the heads of a lot more characters in books two and book three. So if you went through book one and there were characters that you were attached to and you said, well, I would have really liked to have been in their heads as well. Well, good news. You probably will be at some point.
Okay.
And I think the other thing that we can say is the events, you know, that drive forward the narrative in book one and sort of the everything that, you know, brought our characters, the Alliance and the Kastazi together, it's been going on for much longer than you would ever know. This story begins long before the Kastazi ever showed up.
Okay.
The first time on Earth. And so you will get a sense of that and you will get to spend time there across the trilogy. And I would say, you know, we were talking the other day and we're not prepared to say what it is yet, but we were flirting of sometime, you know, within the few months of the book being released on September 8th, releasing the first two lines of book two, just two lines.
Okay.
These two lines, you would read them and be like, holy shit.
Yeah. Was that the tease that you kind of got, I think, at the epilogue?
So much deeper than that.
Okay.
Like you would be like, wow, we did not see this coming.
Oh man, I hate it, but I love it. No, I can't. I seriously, this book was so cool. You know, and I'm really excited to push this out, and you know, also, I, you know, thank you once again for your time. I thought it was so cool to like dive into the, you know, some of the choices you had to make. And I thought it was so interesting that you guys, you know, with your experience in the film and TV industry where you kind of had to switch gears. But, you know, I'm grateful that you did. And I hope that you guys really enjoyed this process. And, you know, I'm sure you've got a lot of other ideas for your future in your career, but I hope you don't, I hope this process didn't scare you away in case you have any other ideas.
We're writing away on book two already.
Nice. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yay. I'm excited. I hate that I have to wait a long time for it, but you know, it's such the world of publishing, you know.
That's very true.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you once again, Elaine Munchen and Glenn Zipper, for taking the time to talk with us today. And, you know, congratulations on your release, and we're looking forward to seeing how it goes.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We really appreciate it.
And I just want to take a moment to thank you for listening to episode 102 of the Nerd Cantina Show. We hope that you enjoyed this interview. And if you stumbled across us for the first time, please rejoin us for our weekly nerd news segments. And join us over at thenerdcantina.com/community, where you can join our private group and discuss the latest books you're reading or whatever other nerd topics you might enjoy. Thanks again. And we'll talk to you next week, nerds.